Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Culinary schools in America are flooded with disciples of Top Chef and Cake Boss, students who think, as seen on TV, that swagger and attitude make a meal. My guest today wasn't like that. He went to the Culinary School of America in a midlife crisis. He was practical and serious about cooking. He was beaten, battered, and permanently seared by his 2 years as a chef in training. He's here to share his culinary school lessons about cooking skills and carrot-peeling attitude, CPA. This hour, On Point, what it takes to become a chef. You can join the conversation. Have you ever dreamed of taking the plunge, quitting cold turkey, going to chef school? Have you done it? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from New York is Jonathan Dixon, former staff writer for Martha Stewart Living. He graduated from the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, in Hyde Park, New York, in 2010. He's now a personal chef and the owner of a small events catering company. His new book about his 2 years as a chef in training is Beaten, Seared, and Sauced, on becoming a chef at the Culinary Institute of America. Jonathan Dixon, welcome to On Point. Thank you.
Oh, hi, Bob. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Give us the backstory. You had a variety of jobs before you tried the culinary track. Give us the thumbnail. Tell us about it.
I had a lot of jobs. As you mentioned, I worked at Martha Stewart for a while, for 7 years, actually. I was a nanny. I was a janitor in a coffin factory. I inspected nurses' shoes, I washed dishes, I taught creative writing, so I sort of covered the waterfront, I think, with a lot of different pursuits.
Well, what do you think you were looking for?
I don't know, something that ultimately really captured my imagination, that something that I could really, really get enthusiastic about, and certainly, you know, being a janitor in a coffin factory was not it.
You were a nervous wreck. You were 38 years old when you decided now was the time to try the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. You knew that you would never own a restaurant. You'd never be a celebrated chef. You'd never be on TV. So why'd you do it?
The CIA represented, to me, it represented a body of knowledge that I couldn't stand not knowing anymore. I had loved cooking since I was a little kid. And when I was just on the cusp of puberty, my mother told me, you know, women actually really like men who cook. So, you know, within seconds of her telling me that, I had an apron on, I was brandishing a wooden spoon, and I just had always had this kind of obsession with cooking, and I couldn't stand not going all the way after a little while.
What was it, do you think, that obsession, that fascination with food at a young age? In some ways, you were driven by your imagination. You wrote that Bilbo Baggins, the Hobbit in Lord of the Rings, roasted a leg of mutton on a spit over an open flame, so you tried it in an oven. Mrs. Ingalls, the Little House on the Prairie mom, made corn cakes with molasses, so you did it too. You read Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and you roasted a goose. What was driving you?
Well, all those meals all sounded so great, and, you know, they seemed so romantic, and cooking had a romance to it, too. I mean, it was just, you know, I've described it, you know, to friends and in the book as this sort of alchemy, almost, and I kind of wanted to master that alchemy as much as I could.
All right, so on to the Culinary Institute of America. What is it in the field of aspiring chefs?
Well, I think, you know, like I said, to me it represented a body of knowledge, and I think to a lot of aspiring chefs and you know, people in the food industry, that it also represents a very rigorous body of knowledge and, you know, a very traditional disciplined approach to, you know, learning the basic craft of cooking.
Was it like boot camp?
In a lot of ways, it was. I mean, I said in the book that it seemed like it was no accident that West Point was just a little bit down the Hudson River. I mean, it felt that way sometimes. I mean, there certainly are quite a few rules and regulations at the Culinary Institute.
Well, tell us about the rules and the rules that maybe bothered you the most. Cut the hair, trim the signboards, always stay clean, always look professional.
That didn't bug me as much. I also have a shaved head, so, you know, the sideburns and the hair was not really an issue for me. But, you know, there I believe it says in the handbook that you were supposed to be wearing white undergarments, which I thought might have been going a little too far. And I have to confess, I sort of flaunted that rule.
So my
boxer shorts were often very multicolored.
So what was it that was frustrating for you, especially maybe at 38 years old?
Well, I think that, you know, if you go back to school as an older student, you know, I'd done college already. I'd been away. I'd been living on my own. It wasn't, you know, my first time out of the house, obviously. For a lot of the students there, this is their first time away from home. And they're there at school and they do all the things that college students usually do when they get away from home for the first time. They go kind of wild. And I think, you know, especially if you're dealing with sharp knives and flames, it's a good idea to, you know, instill, you know, some discipline with people if they're kids. But for me, I mean, I was there to learn. I was there to study. And I didn't feel like I needed that much discipline to buckle under. Nope. I mean, I really wanted to learn.
What was the point in making students knuckle under? Was it too harsh?
No, I mean, if you think back to where your mind was at when you're 17, 18 years old, I mean, it's all over the place and you're reckless and you're, you know, wildly energetic. And I don't necessarily think it was too harsh. I think, you know, they were relatively practical rules ultimately.
Cooking is an industry where most people need to work their way up from the very bottom. As a trained chef from CIA, your first job, you were told by the Institute's president on close to the first day in school, could be simply peeling carrots day after day. Tell us about that lecture and about his message about the carrot peeling attitude.
That's the carrot peeling attitude is a pretty famous speech at the school that President Tim Ryan kind of gives to every incoming class. And there's a new incoming class every 3 weeks. And the context of the carrot peeling thing is, say that you land an internship, or the CIA refers to them as externships, at the French Laundry out in California with Thomas Keller. You know, you as you know, if you're starting in on the bottom rung, you are not going to be doing any serious cooking for a long, long time. Most likely, you are going to be peeling vegetables. So Dr. Ryan's point, I think, was if you're going to peel vegetables, then learn to peel those vegetables as best as humanly possible and as quickly as humanly possible and as efficiently.
And learn to love it.
And, yeah, learn to love the process of it.
You know, you wrote at one point in terms of peeling vegetables, you had that experience and you made it valuable. You made it a valuable lesson to you by keeping track of how many you could peel in a certain amount of time and giving yourself a gold star when you broke your record.
No, that's part of Tim Ryan's speech. I never gave myself a gold star. But when I was doing prep cooking in a kitchen in Brooklyn, I did kind of try to, you know, when I first started out, I could get so much done, and I just kept trying every day to just do more and more as fast as I could without, you know, lopping my fingers off.
For a lot of our listeners, I imagine that there's an interest and a thrill in knowing exactly what happens behind the scenes. Take us through the experience. It took you 2 months to even get to food. What were the classes you had to take before you could even handle food?
Well, you had to take culinary math, you know, and how many milliliters in a cup, and you know, things like that. You had to take a food safety class, which was really, you know, which was really pretty interesting. I mean, you kind of learn that food can really hurt you, you know, if you don't handle it well. You had to take a product knowledge class, which was also a really fascinating class. You basically learned to identify, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of herbs and vegetables and fruits, and learn how to pick the best examples of all of those things. And you also had to take a gastronomy class, which was sort of the philosophy of food and dining.
Give us, you know, I'm sure a lot of our listeners right now are on the other end of the radio, maybe headed to a farm stand this weekend, and they're saying, okay, watermelon is in season in some parts of the U.S. Give us your tip for finding the best watermelon this weekend.
It should feel really heavy. It should feel surprisingly heavy. And that's actually a good general rule for a lot of fruits and vegetables. And the phrase at the CIA was, they should feel heavy in the hand. And, you know, a cantaloupe should feel heavy in the hand. It should have that scent to it. It should have no green under the brown webbing. And it should have a little give if you're, you know, pressing the top where the stem used to be.
Does it give back?
Yes, it'll give back.
No, I don't mean in terms of I don't mean in terms of flavor. I mean seriously, when you're pressing down on it, should it pop back or should it stay down?
No, it should pop back. It should just feel a little bit springy. I mean, if your thumb goes through and it stays down, I think it's probably a little overripe at that point.
What was the most significant thing you learned, you think, and the most surprising thing you learned about picking produce?
That supermarkets often do not carry very good produce. That was kind of a shock.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the rigors of culinary school. My guest today has chopped, seared, and plated his way through the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. Here's Chef Kat Cora, who went on the E! Network's Chelsea Lately in 2010 to make jalapeno poppers with the host, Chelsea Handler.
What I did was I took the cream cheese, I took a little oregano, some garlic powder, and I added this all in, a little bit of salt, and we just mix this. You don't need a lot. The salt, the feta cheese has a lot of salt in it. So what I did was I took jalapenos, you just slice them in half, take the seeds out, and then we're just going to stuff them.
Our guest this hour stuffed a lot of things while he was in the Culinary Institute of America. Jonathan Dixon is with us. He compares cooking school to West Point in his new memoir, Beaten, Seared, and Sauced, on becoming a chef at the Culinary Institute of America. Jonathan, we got a lot of comments already on Facebook. This one from Andrew, who says, I'm a chef. I was trained in Milwaukee and have fired so many kids that came out of the CIA thinking they were the best thing since Kareem, because mommy and daddy could shell out the cash. I don't know how they can graduate these kids when they can't cut a decent Brunois. Am I saying that right? Or remember remember what the mother sauces are. Here's this question to you. You had a tough externship at the New York restaurant Tabla. What do you have to say to Chef Andrew?
Well, I think that, you know, the Culinary Institute, I guess, ultimately isn't any different than any other college. I mean, some people who come out are really good. Other people come out and they're mediocre. I mean, it really ultimately depends on how much you pay attention, how hard you work while you're there, and, you know, how you decide to develop it once you get out. I mean, I've heard before people complain about some CIA students going out into the restaurant world with a really serious attitude. And, you know, that kind of makes no sense to me in a way, because, you know, when you graduate, you're not a chef. I mean, you are at best a cook, and you've been given the tools, hopefully, to learn to become a chef through a lot of hard work and a lot of really rigorous effort. But I think that, you know, you're going to find some bad apples, and you're going to find some really great people who've come out of that school, too.
All right. Lots of callers lining up waiting to talk to you, Jonathan. Carol Ann is on the line from Charlottesville, Virginia. And Carol Ann, as I understand it, you're a chef and a pastry chef.
That's right. Hi, Bob.
Tell us about your experience.
Well, I went to culinary school back in 1991. I was planning to move from Manhattan down here, and it was a change of career. And I basically went because I wanted to have something that would allow me to get a job, basically, when I got down here. I'd always wanted to learn how to cook. I love food. I always have cooked and baked. And so I thought if I had the basics, I could get a job down here. I never thought the culinary school for me was going to be the be-all and end-all. I knew it was going to be more about getting into restaurants and learning the business that way.
So basically, it provided the foundation for you?
Exactly. Exactly. It allowed me to come down here and fill out an application and have something on there beside, yeah, I really like to cook. I had that little piece of paper, and it helped a great deal. When we moved down here, I've never been without work.
And so tell us about the difference between the experience of school and the experience of working in the industry.
The experience at school was, it used to be called Peter Kumpf, New York Cooking School. It's now the Institute for Culinary Education. And it was tough. I went during the summer of 1991 in Manhattan, a third-story walk-up at that time that it was located in. It was hot. It was long hours. But the difference is when you get into the actual working situations, the pecking order is much different. You know, you really are on the bottom. I worked at L'Aal. That was where my externship was, and that's the restaurant that Anthony Bourdain wrote about in Kitchen Confidential. And I had the fry station, and I went to work, and I first thing I did was peel and cut 75 pounds of potatoes and then haul them upstairs and fry them all night. And it's an eye-opener, and it showed me that I'm really not interested in restaurant cooking. There's differences. Catering and restaurant cooking are different. And I was not cut out for restaurant cooking. I prefer catering and doing things where I have more creative control and I can have a wider variety of what I enjoy. I never get bored with what I do.
And you escape the restaurant egos.
And I was listening to that with a smile on my face. I was stunned when I first started at L'Aal. I mean, I had, you know, sous chefs who stood there and said, "See that waiter? I'm going to make him cry." And they were, the arrogance was, I finally said to the one guy, you know, cavemen can cook. You know, they could cook too. You're not solving the world's problems here. You're just, you know, you're practicing a skill that you've learned and you love, and that's great, but it doesn't make you, you know, God. And I had a lot of problem with the egos in the restaurants, I have to say. And I don't think it just came from, you know, CIA students. It was right across the board.
Carol Ann, thank you very much. Jonathan Dixon, talk a little more about your externship, which most college students would call an internship at the restaurant Tabla, high-end Madison Avenue, New York, Indian restaurant, much lauded for a while, closed, as I understand it, in late 2010. Crazy egos and kind of schizophrenic in terms of instruction. You write about how in many instances, you were told to do something one way by one person and then do the very same task in a different way by a different person. Everyone knew the best way.
Yeah, I think everyone has their own preferred method of doing things. And whoever is kind of supervising you at that moment, they want you to do it that way. One of my goals at Tableau was to try to get tasks done as quickly as possible so no one had the chance to come by and tell me that I was doing it wrong. You know, if I had to, you know, dice 40 tomatoes, I would just try to bang through it as quickly as possible because I knew if I dawdled at all, someone was going to show up at my elbow and say, "You're doing it wrong. Start over and do it this way." And I just that was kind of a big motivator for me was to avoid attention.
In some ways, they constantly criticized you about the speed at which you were doing things. Everyone wanted you to be faster, faster, faster.
That's true. Although I tend to think in restaurants you can never be fast enough. So I did at one point wonder whether this was purely motivational or if I really was, you know, like molasses dripping down an iceberg or something, if I was really that slow.
Was it a positive learning experience, your externship?
In some ways, yes, it was. I mean, I went in really respecting Floyd Cardoz, who is the executive chef there, and I left really respecting his cooking and his food there, too. And I learned a lot about how to work with spices, and I loved Indian food and wanted to delve into it more deeply, and I did learn a lot about Indian cuisine while I was there. And they issue you a recipe book when you went into Tabla, and I love that book. I still have it. I still use it.
It's interesting that you have now kind of what seems like a positive memory, because ultimately you write that they insulted you by not feting you by not dunking you in an ice bath, which was something of a tradition for departing employees or externship participants. Did you ever go back there after it closed? I mean, before
after
it closed?
After it closed?
No, before it closed.
I did peek in through the glass the other day, but I didn't go back after I left. I was back upstate. I was in school again, and you know, by the time I was done, like Tabla was getting set to close, and I did not go back.
Any regrets over its closing?
Well, I hate to see anyone's venture fail. I always get really disappointed when I see a restaurant close. I mean, right below my apartment, there was a pizza place that opened about 10 months ago, and the pizza was awful. And I wondered how they stayed open so long. But still, when they closed, I felt really bad for them because, I mean, that business represents someone's investment, represents someone's ambitions and dreams and their passion for what they're doing. And it's not fun to see someone not succeed at what they really want to do.
Peter is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Peter.
Hello there, Bob.
Go right ahead, Peter. Tell us your experience.
I graduated from the Culinary Institute back in 1976, and it was a whole different experience back then than it is today. We did not have internships. We were the last class before that, and they weren't hustling students the way they're hustling them through these days. So it was a whole different experience.
Are you still in the business?
Yes, I am.
What do you do now?
I'm an executive chef at a larger hotel in North Myrtle Beach. I had retired about 2 years ago from a very large catering company. After 15 years, I said, I've had it. And I was brought back into the business about 3 months ago.
Why have you stuck with it for so long?
It's a passion. It's a passion that that developed from a gift. I firmly believe that we all have gifts inside of us, and I was lucky enough to have a man in Ohio to draw that gift out of me in one of my first restaurant positions. He was with me in 6 months into it. He said, "Do you want to go to school?" And I said, and I looked at him very strangely, and I said, "Is there a school that teaches you how to cook?" I couldn't fathom that. And 3 months later, I was at the Culinary Institute.
All right, Peter, thank you. Let's bring another voice to the conversation right now. Sarah Moulton, who was at the Culinary Institute of America at just about the same time he was. She's in the class of 77. She's worked in restaurants in Boston, New York, and France after graduating. Former host of Cooking Live on the Food Network and executive chef for Gourmet Magazine. Host of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on PBS. Sarah Moulton, thanks for speaking with us.
Hi, Bob. Thanks so much.
You were in your mid-20s when you went to cooking school. What were your
aspirations? I was 12. You just blew my cover, darn it.
What was your aspiration back then, whether it's 12 or 20?
Well, you know, the second I walked in the door, I decided I wanted to become a great chef. And what that meant was I wanted to have a little restaurant that was completely excellent and that I would be the chef of it. That is not what I ended up doing, but that was what I wanted to do.
How did the Culinary Institute of America prepare you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've been listening to what everybody's been saying. I think it's the reading, writing, and arithmetic to everything else you do later on in cooking. And I especially advise it for women. There's always that sort of choice. Do you learn on the job or do you go to cooking school first? And I think for women, there's still a fair amount of discrimination out there. It's so much better than it was when I started in the field, but it's still not best. So it helps to be able to say, as I believe it was Carol said earlier, that, you know, you'd gone to cooking school. People knew at least you'd spent that time. And the CIA is a fairly lengthy program. It's 2 years with an externship. By the time, the year after the gentleman before spoke, I was 77, we did have an externship. So you've actually, you know, walked into a restaurant and worked in a restaurant. So I felt that it was really great training. And, you know, back to the whole thing about, you know, hiring people from cooking schools, whether it be the CIA or Johnson & Wales or whatever school, I think it's more the arrogance of youth or the arrogance of a new cook than it is the arrogance of any particular cooking school. I think when you first start cooking, and especially if you're young, but if you're a young cook, you know, you're new to cooking, you think you know everything right off the bat. It doesn't matter what you do really know or what they tell you in cooking school, because all the cooking schools tell you you're not a chef. You still walk in with a ton of arrogance. So I used to make sure that when I hired somebody, I asked them a fair amount of, you know, insightful questions, and I also looked and saw how well they were doing in school. The better they were doing in school, the more likely they were going to be a better worker. I was still going to have to knock that chip off their shoulder, though.
I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point. Sarah Moulton, I'm wondering, so therefore, do you think that a degree in cooking school is more or less necessary in the restaurant world right now? In the real world, do most of the people you encounter, most of the people who come to you maybe looking for jobs, have culinary school degrees?
They do. I mean, again, there's some truly great chefs, far better than I'll ever be, who learned on the job. And I'm not, you know, scarfing at that, but that takes more time. I'm not saying it takes more time than school, but the advantage of school is when you go to a school like the Culinary Institute, you're exposed to 20, 30 chefs in 2 years. When you work at a restaurant, you know, you work with that one chef, plus, you know, the line cooks, and you learn from them too, but you only work with one chef in that style of cooking and that menu for a year, and then perhaps you go to another restaurant the next year, whereas it's sort of all accelerated and condensed when you go to cooking school. So that's the advantage. I'm not going to say that one is better than the other. I think for a woman trying to break into the field, it's a good idea to go to cooking school. But other than that, I think both things are equally valid as long as you're willing in the industry to spend some time working in those restaurants and learning.
A little over a minute left, Sarah. Let me ask you this question. Now, your current show, Sarah's Weeknight Meals on PBS, features very accessible cooking to reach the broader audience of home chefs. Did you have to unlearn precision, perfection, or what that you did learn at the CIA?
No, I didn't really. It was my life. I've always worked, you know, a million hours. But especially when I started working at Gourmet, I was like anybody else. I'd come home at 5 or 6 and have to make dinner for my family. So I really got into the mindset of a home cook and how do I get dinner on the table. And that has become my mission in life, is to help people to do that. And so I try to think from the point of view of a home cook, not as a professional chef.
Sarah Moulton, thank you so very much for speaking with us. We appreciate it, and continued good luck with the show and your career.
Right, thank you, and I'm looking forward to getting this book and reading it.
Sarah's Weeknight Meals is a show on PBS. Her most recent cookbook is Sarah Moulton's Everyday Family Dinners. Sarah Moulton graduated from the Culinary Institute of America in 1977. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about how professional chefs are made. Superstar chef Gordon Ramsay is known for his excellence and also his incredibly hot temper. Here he is venting frustration on his Fox TV show, Hell's Kitchen.
No, I've had enough! It's undercooked! It's such a shame!
Jonathan Dixon joins us now. He souped and sauced his way through the Culinary Institute of America, class of 2010. His new book is Beaten, Seared, and Sauced on Becoming a Chef. And, you know, you had many experiences like that in a way, Jonathan Dixon. Chefs, for example, in a fish fillet class, I recall you writing about how a chef was banging his knife on the table and yelling over and over again, the knife must be flat.
Yeah, keep your knives flat. Keep your knives flat. Yes, a lot of that went on.
On the positive side, in a gastronomy class, the professor had you do an experiment with chocolate that I found very interesting in terms of how it might help you train your palate to be more sophisticated, which wasn't necessarily the exact lesson being taught. Do you remember it? You called your experience profound and dramatic.
Yes, I do remember that. The experiment was we started out eating an incredibly bitter piece of chocolate, and it was just alkaline in the mouth, and it was something I almost spit out, and if I had had a napkin, I probably would have. And then we just kept eating chocolates that we started with one chocolate that was relatively sweet and just kept building in bitterness from there until we got back at the very end to that same first piece of chocolate. And when I tasted it at that time, after my palate had kind of been adjusting and readjusting, it tasted completely different, and it had more complexity of flavor and more nuance to it than that first, you know, moment I had tried it a few minutes before.
What was your favorite class and why?
I think my favorite class was, I would have to say, the Skills 3 class. I'm tempted to say the Fish class because I really loved the instructor, but it was only 7 days, so I have to go with the full 3-week course. The Skills 3 class, which was taught by Gerard Koyak.
Which taught you what?
It was sort of refined in a pretty intense environment. It refined the skills that we'd kind of been taught in the Skills 1 and Skills 2 class. And those were the classes where you learned to chop onions and to, you know, peel potatoes quickly, and then how to make a basic sauce, how to saute well, how to braise, et cetera, and how to make stock and all that sort of thing. And in Koyak's class, you know, that was the first class where we served what we cooked to other students. So it was really, at that moment, it was really great to see all these things, that some of which seemed almost abstract when we were doing it, like, you know, putting a stock together. It was great to see all those things kind of come to fruition, you know, in Koyak's class, and then to put that stuff on plates and hand it to other students.
All right. Honesty now, which class did you hate the most?
Well, there were a couple academic classes that I found unbelievably tedious, especially the second math course I had to take there, which I have no idea how I passed that thing. It was at 7 in the morning, and I had to drive an hour to school, and you know, it was finding, you know, profit margin percentage and that sort of thing. And it was pretty deadening, I have to admit. As far as the cooking classes go, there was nothing I hated, but I don't know that I had an experience there I really disliked as far as any of the cooking classes go. I kind of was able to pull something useful out of all of them.
Steve is on the line from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. What was your experience?
I had gone into culinary school after being working in restaurants a little bit here and there, and then in the 90s I went to a culinary school, a two-year program like at the CIA. So I'd gotten a degree and worked really hard to get that and learned a lot. Thought I knew a lot when I came out and felt that, you know, because of all the knowledge I had gained, that I must really have a lot together. And so I got into the business and found that just a short time after that I really didn't know very much, because I kept learning a lot more when I got into the restaurant end of it and working as a chef, which was really hard work, by the way. It's very long hours. The kitchens are not friendly. There's always people yelling, and it's really hot all the time. But and it's hard work because you just keep doing repetitive work. And had I probably, you know, known enough about it in advance, I might not have chosen that as a career, but I really liked food and I really liked cooking, and I wanted to know what I was doing in the kitchen. And that part really I still use today, even though I don't really cook in a kitchen. I'm still in food service, but I'm not cooking anymore.
So you stuck with the career in a way. What are you doing now?
I did. And now I do sales. I work for a distributorship, and so I do sales. But I work around chefs a lot because that's all I do is talk to people who cook in their own kitchens and so on. And one of the things I found, too, was there's a lot of people in the business that never went to any kind of schooling and just did it because there was something that they wanted to do or they needed a business, they needed to have a living, and got into the business and maybe opened up a restaurant never having any experience and then, you know, can't figure out why they're not successful. And doing what I do now, I can tell which ones are just not going to be successful and which ones are just going to barely hang on by the skin of their teeth until they finally quit. You know, and that's what normally happens to a lot of restaurants is that they close down within the first 10 years. 10% will survive and 90% will go away.
Knowing now what you know, would you do it all over again if you had to do it all over again?
Only for the personal gain, you know, the personal knowledge. I like the knowledge that I've got. I like meeting the people that I met in the business that really did teach me a lot. There were a lot of chefs that did know something, and there were a lot of chefs that had come through school that didn't know anything. So you get shoemakers and you get chefs when you get into culinary schools. And so, and not to put down the shoemaking industry, but that's what we called them. We called them cobblers if they couldn't really do anything in a kitchen.
Steve, thank you very much for talking about your experience. Let's talk to another in the business. Polly is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Polly.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm great. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I have two careers. I was a practicing lawyer for 18 years in New York City. And when I went on maternity leave, I decided to go to culinary school. Like one of the previous callers, I too went to Peter Kumpf's, which is now the Institute of Culinary Education, because there is a program given by Nick Malgieri, his Baking and Pastry Arts program, which is a four-month program. I did that, got my diploma, and then I did a four-month, then I moved to Boston, and I did a four-month externship with, I would say, the best restaurant in Boston, which is still going on now. And I've worked in the business ever since then, since 94, and because I am an older pastry chef, I am so glad that I did this.
A better job than being a lawyer?
It's different. It is very hard. All the other callers have talked about the long hours and the yelling and the ridiculous kitchens that everybody has to work in, and you're, you know, 4 inches of counter space, and the emergencies that go on, and stamping out forest fires all the time. It's a very difficult but interesting problem-solving career to be in, because if you are doing something and you think you have it under control, well, you may not. And with my age and maturity, I found that I could solve problems a lot faster than younger people who perhaps would just sort of freak out and break down and cry. I decided, as I said, after about 15 years in the business, I've worked for famous celebrity chefs who you know, and also for excellent restaurants here in Boston. Just because of various financial reasons, at this point I am planning on going back to practicing law. Not that I really, really want to, because I love pastry work so much, and I'm still doing it on my own. As a matter of fact, I'm making a cherry pie as we speak.
But are you doing that because you're having trouble making a living at it?
Well, I will say that with the recession, people have cut back. My last job was with a very famous dessert restaurant in Boston, and people cut back a lot. You know, sales were not as good as they once were. People decide twice after, you know, a dinner, should they spend money on an extravagant luxury like a dessert, perhaps, and they're not as much. And I found that it was, you know, difficult with staff cutbacks and everything else, you know, running the place as efficiently as I could.
Polly, who's debating her life between briefs and baguettes from being a pastry chef or being a lawyer. Jonathan Dixon, back to you. For someone considering attending CIA or one of the other many fine culinary schools, would you recommend it?
It really depends on the individual circumstances. I mean, there are no guarantees that you're going to see success once you get out. But I mean, I think that's the same with anything. Like, you know, if you go and get an MFA, you're not guaranteed to publish a novel afterwards. But if you can do it, if you have the wherewithal, the financial wherewithal, if you have the time and the ability, then there are certainly a whole lot of worse things you could do.
And you're going to stick with it, what is now your catering business for the foreseeable future, as far as you know?
Yes, I am.
Jonathan Dixon, author of Beaten, Seared, and Sauced on Becoming a Chef at the Culinary Institute of America, a personal chef, owner of a small events catering company. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you, Bob. I really appreciate being on.
In a moment, NPR Robert Krulwich's advice for 2011 graduates. This is On Point. In this college graduation season, we're going to be airing excerpts from notable commencement addresses around the country. Last Saturday, NPR science correspondent and Radiolab co-host Robert Krulwich addressed the graduating class of the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He said he understood the job market may look daunting right now, but not to fear for the future.
News, after all, is the spin of words and pictures, and it's a kind of music. There are beats in any newspaper, any newscast. Ed Murrow sounded like Ed Murrow. Huntley and Brindley sounded different. Anderson Cooper, different still. When you grow up in different decades, you laugh at different jokes, you hear different machines. I heard typewriters, you computers, I heard pinball machines, you Mario Brothers, whatever. You hear different ads, jingles, songs, sounds. And when you write a film or talk or work, and the music is inside you, that's the music that formed you, and the only music you have is the music you know. Different generations have different musics in them. So whatever they do, it's going to come out differently. And you will speak in the beat of your generation. You don't know how else to do it. The people in charge don't want to change. They like the music they've got, and to the newcomers, they say, well, wait your turn. But in a world like this, rampant with new technologies and new ways to do things, the newcomers, that's you here today, you have to trust in your music. That's how you talk to each other, that's how you talk to your generation, and that's how the country changes. After all, when it began in the 1930s, Time magazine, the weekly news magazine, was a radical idea created by young Henry Luce and some college friends. The New Yorker got its beats from James Thurber, his buddy E.B. White, and their buddy Harold Ross. I was at Rolling Stone when Jan Wenner put together that amazing gang of writers and designers and critics from my generation, and Ira Glass did it again with the Gen Xers. Each of these groups, they have a shared feel. They're expressing something that belongs to their age and their time. So for this age, your time, I want you to think about this. I want you to think about not waiting your turn. Instead, think about getting together with friends that you admire, people you envy. Think about entrepreneuring. Think about not waiting for a company to call you up. Think about not giving your heart to a bunch of adults that you don't know. Think about horizontal loyalty. Think about turning to people you already know, who are your friends or friends of their friends, and think about making something that makes sense to you together, that's as beautiful and as true as you can make it. And when it comes to security, to protection, your friends may take better care of you than CBS took care of Charles Kuralt at the end. In every career, your job is to make and tell stories, of course, and you're going to build a body of work. But you will also build a body of affection with the people you've helped and who've helped you back. And maybe that's your way into Troy. Here you are, on the beach with the other newbies, looking up. And maybe somebody inside will throw you a key and let you in, but most likely, most of you will have to find your own Trojan horse. And maybe for your generation, the Trojan horse is what you've already got. Your talent, backed by a legion of friends, and not friends in high places. This is the era of friends in low places. The ones you meet now, who will notice you and challenge you, work with you, watch your back, and they will be your strength. And if you choose to go this way, you won't have Charles Kuralt's instant success. It'll take time, and it will probably be very lonely. A living room is not a newsroom, and it never feels like one, and you know you're alone. And on the way, you may get scarily close to not being able to afford the living room. But what I've noticed is that people who fall in love with journalism and who stay at it and who stay stubborn, they very, very often win. I don't know why, but I've seen it happen over and over. So here, for what it's worth, ladies and gentlemen of the class of 2011, here's my final graduation advice. Some of you will say, well, this is like a silly fantasy by an old guy. Pay no attention to this man. However, you invited me, so here's what you get. If you can, fall in love with the work, with the people you work with your dreams and their dreams, and whatever it was that got you into this school, don't let it go. Whatever kept you here, don't let that go. Believe in your friends. Believe in what you and your friends have to say, and that the way you're saying it is something new in the world. And don't stop. Just hold on and keep loving what you love, and you'll see, in the end, they will let you stay. Thank you.
NPR science correspondent Robert Krulwich addressing journalism graduates at the University of California, Berkeley. I'm Bob Oakes in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.